You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. It is said that prostitution is one of the world's oldest professions. In the early years of the 20th century, the town of Eureka, California, benefited significantly from that profession, and now there's an effort to recognize the women who helped fund the town's early infrastructure. Here to help us learn more is my guest, Lynette Mullen, a historian in Eureka. Welcome, Lynette.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with the history. When was Eureka incorporated as a city, and what attracted people to the region?
Eureka was incorporated in the 1850s, and initially folks were just looking for an easier, quicker way to get to the gold mines, which were inland. But as more people came to the coast and this area, they recognized that we had such rich natural resources for good and bad, because later people ended up exploiting them. But this recognition that we had timber and we had pasture land and we had fish and we had all these other things that the region could offer to settlers drew people in. We also had a bay, and so a port could be developed.
Okay, so you had a lot of resources, natural resources, but not a lot of money. Can you paint a picture of Eureka's financial situation in the early 1900s?
Yeah, so Eureka had done well for a long time. They continued to grow as industry developed here. But in the early 1900s, the city of Eureka, the city itself, was facing a lot of demands for infrastructure, you know, new roads, new streets. City services, police coverage, all those things that a growing city needs, and the revenue streams that they had at the time, frankly, did not cover those demands.
Okay, and so one of the professions in the region was the red light district. Tell me about it.
Yes, so Eureka and Humboldt County really had ladies of the evening since the 1850s. The more proper folks in the area weren't necessarily proud of it, but there were a lot of single men first that came in drawn to the gold rush, and then as industry developed, there were a lot that worked in the woods. There were a lot of sailors. There was a taboo against premarital sex, so you had a lot of young men in the area with what some people would argue are physical needs. And so these ladies, who also at the time, there were a lot of women who maybe were orphaned, whose husbands had died, who were struggling financially for any number of reasons, prostitution was a way for them to actually make a livable wage. And so those two kind of circumstances came together, and we ended up with a pretty vibrant red light district. Especially the other cities, just for various reasons, kind of pushed the women out. And Eureka realized that not only was it a draw for men that would come in and maybe visit the ladies that spend a lot of money, those men would also, you know, buy boots and spend money at the saloons. And so Eureka, even before this revenue system was developed, recognized that these women could be a resource.
Okay, so the city saw an opportunity.
Yes. And by 1903, the city, again, there were all these demands. City is broke. Initially, when they were kind of spitballing a way to make extra money, they talked about taxing the women. But then they had to face the fact that what they were doing in the red light district was illegal. They then talked about charging the women for being in a house or running a house. And often these were called resorts. But someone told city officials, well, if you charge them under this state vagrancy law, it's actually the county gets the money. And so the city went, okay, that's not going to work for us. And so the city realized by the fall of 1903, they implemented a system of charging the women for selling liquor without a license, whether they had or not. They would charge the women. The women would go into court. They would plead guilty. They would pay their bail, and initially it was $30, and it went up to $50 by like 1907, 1908, and then they just wouldn't show up back at court. So they would, quote, forfeit their bail, so it was effectively a fine. But that fine then went into the city general fund. City could use it to fund their police department, fund their infrastructure. It just became a regular revenue stream. because after that time, every 6 months or a year, mostly depending on the city budget, I think, the women would get, quote, arrested again and would come in and pay that fine.
Okay, so in 1903, the city only had about $1,156 on hand, according to the records that we've seen. How significant was the $840 contribution, if you can call it that, from the red light district that same year?
Oh, it was huge. I mean, so it was in 1903, I've got a chart here. It ended up making the contribution from the women was over 40% of the Eureka Police Department's revenue stream. I mean, and so you can imagine the impact that that would make, you know, if it was over half of what the city had on hand. And different years, I was able to find the Eureka Police Department's cash book. And in certain years, the revenue just from these systematic fines, because the women were arrested and fined for other things as well, but just the systematic fines, like in 1906, was 69% of the Eureka Police Department's revenue. In 1908, it was almost 60%. So it was a huge contribution to the city.
So that's interesting, because now you have these police officers, their salaries are basically being subsidized by these ladies of the evening at these resorts. And you've described a system of coordinated efforts where police would tip off the madams about upcoming so-called arrests. And it seems like everybody was in on the game.
So I guess I have to correct that misconception. No, what this system did was it created, for better or worse, a relationship between the madams and the resorts, as we'll call them, and the police department, because there was kind of this implied understanding or permission for these women to engage in this illegal activity. When something bad happened, let's say a client got violent, or unfortunately there were a lot of women in the district that were unhappy, there were a lot of suicide attempts, this relationship with the city allowed these women, even though they were engaging in an illegal activity, it allowed the women to be able to call on the officers and get help, which was, as you pointed out and maybe thought it was in the beginning, it was very different in other communities when these women were engaging in an illegal activity. If they needed help and called the police, they risked being arrested. So a lot of people, you know, it made the women much more vulnerable when they didn't have this sort of an agreement with the city and with the police department.
Gotcha. My guest is Lynette Mullen, a historian in Eureka working on a monument to the sex workers of the early 20th century whose taxes funded the city's early infrastructure. Lynette, your research shows that between 1900 and 1914, these women contributed nearly $14,000 to the city coffers. And that translates to what amount in today's value?
About $500,000.
Wow.
It was hugely significant. And I do want to say that even though, and this is part of why we're doing the monument, so even though the women early on had this agreement with the police department, over time, as the reform movement moved west and then north to Eureka in our isolated little area, it took a little while for reformers to find us. But as pressure mounted, the attitude of the police and the police department and other officials changed. And they became more and more punitive. You know, so like in the fall of 1907, even though this agreement was in place and this money was being spent, in the fall of 1907, the women in the district were required to sleep within the borders of the district and would literally be arrested if they were found outside of the city's district at night for no other reason than not being within these confines that the city had outlined. They also started doing raids. So the police department, because they were being pressured, started going into brothels at 3 a.m. and looking for, they said, men, vagrants that were just spending the night there, you know, maybe didn't have jobs or employment. So the idea was to crack down on these men, but the women were arrested too, like literally at 3 a.m. just because there was someone in their room. There were no warrants required. There was a Eureka Police Department investigation in 1912, and one of the officials was like, well, what about warrants? And one of the officers went, well, no, the girls don't need warrants. We never use warrants in that area.
Well, the city maintained, as you said, this designated district bordered by the waterfront and Fifth Street and A and E Streets. So it kind of boxed them in. How did this geographic confinement serve the city's interests while simultaneously marginalizing the people living there?
So it was interesting. And if you walk, if you start at Eureka's waterfront, where everybody got off the steamer, Eureka was isolated for a very long time. And pretty much everybody came in and out by steamer or waterfront in Old Town Eureka. You can see, physically see, how the city evolved. And at one point in the 1880s, a little after, Eureka officials kind of fancied themselves as the San Francisco of the North. You know, so they started building more ornate buildings. You can see that. They're beautiful. We've got a lot of beautiful Victorian buildings. But as this kind of identification grew, right, these dreams of Eureka, they still wanted and felt that they needed the women, that they served a purpose, but they didn't want to see them anymore. And so the district got pushed out of this main commercial area south and west. And you can still see that today. You know, we've got these beautiful ornate Victorians along, you know, First and Second, kind of East Street, kind of northeast. But as you move southwest, the buildings are, shorter, squatter, uglier. I mean, still, you can, and the energy is different. And people have talked about that a lot. The center of the district used to be by our co-op, which is it's an amazing store, but you can, that's still where kind of the struggling population congregates. I mean, people still feel the energy because this was a difficult job. None of these women grew up wanting to have sex with, you know, loggers that hadn't bathed for a month, or men, you know, sailors coming off the boat. They did this career by necessity or by force. And so it was hard, you know, and then there they were.
And to that point, some of these women were actual entrepreneurs, but you highlight a darker side of this history, including sex trafficking and the Federal White Slave Traffic Act of 1910.
Yes. So strangely, I mean, Eureka was first for a couple of those, but in 1910, there was this growing recognition that women were being trafficked, so that part's good. Federal government passed a law making it illegal to bring women across state lines, and it was actually two young girls that were living in Eureka that got seduced by two men. The girls were what they called half-orphans, so their father had died. Girls were trying to make it and support their mother, and these two men basically swept them off their feet and promised them marriage, a better life. But the men said, we're going to go up to Oregon, Portland. We're going to start our new life there. And the girls went with them. And once they got to Portland, they're alone. They've got no money. They're under the control of these two men. They ended up being trafficked. Through a series of events, this came to light. And these two men, at least what I've read, and I haven't done a nationwide search, but from what I've read, these two men were the first convicted in the country under the White Slave Act.
Oh, wow. What a story. We only have a minute left, and I just want you to tell me, you're currently working with the mayor and the Inc. People Center for Arts and Culture on this project. Tell me quickly about this project.
Yes. So we are creating a monument. I really want to recognize these women, clearly, with all the history. Once the mayor, Kim Burdell, here in Eureka, learned more about the history, she is absolutely committed to creating something to commemorate the women. So we were able to work through Inc. People. They do Dream Maker projects, and so they've taken us on. So it's inkpeople.org, and then if you click on Dream Maker, and there's a million benefits to working with Inc. People, but one is it makes every contribution to our monument tax deductible. People can literally click on a button and help support this project. And there have been a number of people. There seems to be a lot of folks that can relate to a social and political climate that exploits and marginalizes and sexualizes women. For some reason, that's still familiar. And so we are getting support, but we need more. We're going to be working with an artist. We want to create something beautiful and respectful. And so that's what we're working on.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing this interesting story and for the work that you're doing, Lynette.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
My guest was Lynette Mullen, a historian in Eureka working on a monument to the sex workers of the early 20th century whose taxes funded the city's early infrastructure. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.